a gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
In today's episode of Project Recovery,
I think I've seen that happen more and more each year where a patient comes in for a new visit just requesting to either A, be off their opioid, or B, have options outside of that opioid to better control or manage their pain.
But our work is not finished. We still have significant amounts of work to do, and so we are going to continue in these efforts.
Make sure you listen to the end. Find us on Facebook at Project Recovery. We'll have that and much more coming up. Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, it's about recovery, and it's brought to you by our friends at KnowYourScript.org. You know, KnowYourScript.org is really responsible for letting us to do this week in and week out, and so we really want to say thank you to them. And one way we can say thank you to them, Dr. Matt, is by talking to some of their partners in the industry out there. And you're out there because you're a clinical psychologist.
Yes.
And so I think you're going to be really, you know, focused on this one because we're talking to other doctors.
Well, a physician specifically, and they can teach us a lot about what's going on with the opioid crisis and prescription drugs in general, and then great advice for consumers of those drugs.
And then when we had the second part of the podcast today, we're going to talk to somebody about some pain management clinics. So first and foremost, let's get started. Our guest today is Dr. John Benfield. He's the DO. I don't even know what that is. What is a DO?
Oh, good question. So, yeah, it's a doctor of osteopathic medicine. So with medical schools, there's the allopathic schools, which are noted as MD or medical doctor, and then DOs. So very similar to our dental colleagues with DMD and DDS. And that just designates where you went to medical school.
Okay. And you're with Intermountain Healthcare. What do you want patients to know before they start taking an opioid for pain management?
That's a great question. So lots of topics to cover there. First of all, it's, you know, medicine is great because we evaluate things with, you know, evidence-based science, but in a clinic, it's really a one-on-one conversation to identify first where they're having pain at, you know, how long they've had the pain, what type of things the pain's changing their lifestyle. Is it really getting in the way of things like sleep, exercise, family time, relationships, and then evaluating what's been done to not only work up what's causing the pain, but also see what's been done to treat it. And so those are some kind of basic topics, in my opinion, that people should talk with their patients about. And even patients being proactive in bringing that information to their physician before they talk not only about opioids, but just any medication or whatever that next step is, you know, in their treatment, kind of their treatment journey with pain.
And that's why Know Your Script is so important, is because having those conversations with your doctor, having those conversations with yourself, having those conversations with your loved ones. You know, this podcast is all about addiction, but more importantly, recovery. And a lot of people who have come on this podcast aren't big fan of opioids, and they want to swear them off and say that they are the devil. And we try to tell people on here, opioids have their place in medicine. Opioids have their place in the society, and they have their place in helping others get through the pain that they need. And I think that's very important because we just need people to know that opioids do serve a purpose, and those purposes are helping people manage their pain.
Correct. Yeah, I think with any medication, opioids included, I mean, we should be direct with what we prescribe. You know, we know what we're prescribing it for. We know what our outcomes should be for that specific patient, which side effects, you know, we should be watching for. With opioids, other medications as well. I mean, it's always a risk benefit ratio, and then that's balanced with, you know, what the patient is going through, what other allergies or medications they may be on. You know, one of the things we look really closely at with patients who are on opioids is, are they on other medications like benzodiazepines or other medications that may interact with the opioid that would, you know, increase the risk? And then what they've tried in the past, you know, some patients have allergies or have had side effects to other medications we may use instead of opioids. And so sometimes opioids are the only medication left over for them to trial. We have a lot of cancer patients that unfortunately experience that, where their pain's been severe enough where other medications just aren't working, or they're contraindicated based upon their medication history.
You know, Doc, one of the things that we get on the show a lot, questions, and I think people feel comfortable asking me because I'm a PhD, not an MD or a DO, is they get kind of uncomfortable or hesitant to bring up some of their questions to the prescriber. So I think it would be helpful for the listeners, like if you had somebody coming in and you thought an opioid or similar medication was warranted, how would you recommend they bring up their questions to you?
That's a great question. And I think it's something we miss out on a lot in the medical realm, on making sure patients are having a good experience in our office. And what I mean by that is they come in and they feel welcome, they feel safe, and that the provider, whether it's a physician or a physician assistant or nurse practitioner, that they feel like they can approach the provider with their most vulnerable questions. And that includes questions on medications that maybe have a stigma to them. And opioids are in that category where people have gotten a lot of information, which is great. You want the general population and to be educated about medications, but you also want to make sure they feel safe in your office asking those questions. You know, one of the things I'll try to do is a couple times throughout the appointment, just ask if they have any questions. Maybe ask, you know, have you heard about this group of medications, or you took this in the past, what was your experience? So I think open-ended questions, you may have to ask the same question a couple different times to make them feel comfortable with you. And I think we underestimate in medicine how intimidating or maybe scary it can be for a patient to come to a new office and especially discuss not only pain, but other medical history.
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it right there. It's funny to me, I end up coaching because people will ask me, you know, in a therapy session about the medicine. And I say, well, you know, this is a question for your prescriber. Why don't we go back and coach them a little bit on how to ask? Because I think you're absolutely right. Sometimes people feel intimidated. What about asking you guys about alternatives to something like an opioid? Is that okay? Like, is it okay if they were to ask you questions about other medications or other things besides an opioid? Does that offend the physician in any way?
Not at all. And I would hope that all anyone on an opioid or has been on one, and anyone with chronic pain, that conversation would not only be brought up by the patient, but would be initiated by the provider. One of the things that we see in our clinic is patients who haven't been offered additional therapies, whether it's something maybe as basic as a different non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, maybe changing a dosage of a daily Tylenol, maybe it's a different approach to physical therapy, and other patients who may want things like acupuncture or chiropractic care. I have a lot of patients that notice a difference with those modalities, massage therapy. So yeah, I think not only should the patient want to have that conversation, it should be encouraged by the provider that they're seeing.
Now, doctor, let me ask you this question, because I think all of us ultimately would love to be 100% pain-free, but is that realistic?
That's a good question. That comes up almost daily. A couple caveats I would think. I think, you know, generally, and this is just kind of my own, I guess, personal thought process, you know, none of us really get through life without experiencing some type of pain, whether that's physical or emotional or you know, professional stress or pain. Patients who've had chronic pain, kind of defined as pain longer than 3 months, and they've had an appropriate workup. Yeah, often we have to have that expectations conversations on, one, what are they expecting? And then two, sometimes we see improvements in people's care that can't be quantified or qualified by like a pain score or a pain reduction. And so, but we'll hear things like, you know, I'm able to play with my grandchildren. Hey, doc, I was able to go walk today. I can get through the grocery store without being in as much pain. And I think we can point those out to people. We can start to focus on kind of functional goals along with, you know, any reduction in pain, whether that's on a 0 to 10 scale, or we're looking at percentage of pain relief. But yeah, often 100% pain relief, you know, immediately after starting a medication, an injection, a therapy, can be kind of an unrealistic expectation. Now that may be different. So say maybe it's a high school athlete who hurts their, say they tear their ACL or their rotator cuff, playing a sport, you know, they may get to a point where that specific injury, you know, they have 100% pain relief with that specific injury. But generally, yeah, I think expectation conversations on 100% pain relief, as well as kind of focusing more on the forest picture and not the tree, on, well, let's see what else is getting better in your life, could help them not only feel successful with the treatment, but better evaluate if the treatment they're getting is appropriate for them.
That's some good psychology there, Doc. Let's look behind the curtain a little bit, though. So in your world, in the physician's world of treating pain, you know, I think in the past, a lot of the folks that we've had come on this show have talked about, you know, how in the past 20, 30 years ago, it was so easy, or easier at least, to get these prescriptions. And now there's been a lot of conversation in the public, thanks to people like Know Your Script and others, talking about this being an epidemic and how the physicians themselves are having a whole new perspective on prescribing. What's going on from just a professional standpoint? Are there conversations that you and your colleagues have about how often painkillers are being prescribed and in what ways and to whom? Is it really different? Is it really changing from kind of what you guys are doing from your side? Or is that more just kind of a public perspective?
No, I think what we're seeing is better transparency with our patients on kind of the thought process that us as physicians and advanced practice providers like nurse practitioners and PA, what we go through in deciding if an opioid is appropriate. And I've seen that nationally when I go to national conferences and that involve around pain, is we want to make sure patients on any medication, especially opioids, are safe. And with opioids, that means a couple things. One, it means, are you on any other medications that may make an opioid less safe for you at this time? And then B, are we being transparent, and are we following guidelines? For example, with a medication management agreement, you know, toxicology screens can be helpful in making sure there's no other chemicals a patient's taking that would make opioids less safe. So I think what we're seeing is physicians and APPs, advanced practice providers, being more thoughtful in who they're prescribing to, and also making sure that we're being safe and how we monitor our patients on it. And I know our office, that's how we try to address, is that it's, we want them to come in and realize that we're a team. Every decision is mutual and consensual, but with opioids, that there are some additional monitoring that we have to do for the medication to make sure it's being used safely, but also that it's not causing any, you know, unidentified side effects that could threaten someone's quality or quantity of life. So yeah, what patients are seeing, I think, largely parallels conversations doctors are having at a local, state, and national level to just try to be more responsible with this group of medications.
Making it a lot harder for people to do the old-fashioned doc shopping, right? To get the...
Yeah, there is some of that. I don't think I see that as much. I think I often get more patients coming in asking to come off and try other medications. Hey, what else is available? Okay. And the patients we do get in that may be looking for, you know, care with a new doctor, or they want to have the flexibility to go to several physicians for opioids, is kind of addressing with them kind of the safety risk associated with that, but also helping providers to not shame those patients or make them feel guilty, to actually, you know, reach out, show them that there may be a little bit better way to control their pain and kind of get them back to the life they want to get. So,
do you have patients come in and admit up front, like, oh, I've had a problem with this in the past? Or, like, I think there is, you mentioned, you know, physicians not shaming patients, but I think which is great, of course. But I think there's also a lot of patients walk around with a lot of shame, which keeps them using. And what do you think of somebody who comes in and just, you know, admits openly that that's been a problem for them?
Absolutely. Yeah. I've patients are really willing to want to get better. And I think sometimes as physicians, we underestimate that. So yeah, that's a very common occurrence where they come in and just say, you know, doctor, I'd like to be off these medications. Can we look at lower dosing? What else is available? And I think a large part of that has been, you know, campaigns like this, national groups like the CDC recommending, you know, conversations with your physician, educating the public that opioids can be appropriate for some people, but, you know, there's risk associated. So, yeah, that's a very common occurrence. And personally, I think I've seen that happen more and more each year where a patient comes in for a new visit just requesting to either A, be off their opioid, or B, have options outside of that opioid to better control or manage their pain.
Now, Dr. Benfield, we've been doing this podcast for close to 2 years now, and I think a lot of people who have shared their stories on this have painted their doctors in a bad light, that it was the doctors who prescribed the opioids that got them hooked. And I think some of the
I like to stand up for the doctors, though. I try.
Yeah, but I think some of the blame has to go back to the people taking the prescription. That's why I think these programs like Know Your Script are so important, because you're talking to somebody with an addict brain. And so when I see a prescription that says take one every 2 to 4 hours and it makes me feel better, my brain automatically goes taking 2 to 3 is going to make me feel better. So we really need to follow the prescription to what it says and be honest with them and actually use the prescription for what it's intended for. Correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think absolutely in two ways. One, patients knowing that any change in the dosage, the frequency, or how they take the medication should be discussed with the doctor whose name's on the bottle. Because one, it usually can help them problem solve why they may feel like they want to take more or less. And especially with opioids, you know, you always want to make sure that your patients feel comfortable reaching out so that if they say it feel like they need to take more, they can be appropriately worked up because maybe there's a new medical condition or concern that needs to be addressed. Or other times when they want to take less, to make sure that as they wean off those opioids, they do it with a mutual conversation with their provider or prescriber, so they're not going to be experiencing any unnecessary withdrawal symptoms or get themselves in a situation that could have been prevented by having a conversation with their prescriber. So, yeah, I think there needs to be responsibility on both sides. And that goes back to that first patient visit of just trying to encourage each other to be honest and open with one another and being able to feel like you can reach out and ask questions, you know, and get the answers you want regarding your healthcare.
I feel like that's been very common when I've taken my kids in or I've had a surgery myself. And I feel like that's a shift just in the practice of medicine in general, where physicians themselves are much more open and initiating those conversations, as opposed to, I think, you know, maybe 30 years ago when there wasn't as much of that on the populace's mind to talk about. And so I think we all as patients appreciate physicians that slow down and do that and talk with us a little bit and make it feel like we can ask those questions. Casey, you may not know this, but I've found that DO physicians like Dr. Benfield are a little more open to alternative things. Do you ever talk with your patients about things like meditation for pain management? That's something Casey and I both do quite a bit, is meditate. And I've attended some seminars on meditation for pain management. I just wondered what your thoughts are.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big believer that anything that we can look at to decrease someone's pain, and often unfortunately, depression, anxiety, insomnia, post-traumatic stress disorder can often accompany pain. And so our office, believe it or not, actually has more psychologists than physicians. And that's intentional because I think, especially in pain medicine, things like mindfulness, cognitive behavioral therapy, evaluating someone's coping skills that they're using for their pain, and then maybe learning new coping skills or how to improve some that you already have, I think it goes a long way to de-intensify or de-amplify pain. you know, I have a lot of patients too that come in and they'll say things like, you know, doctors, this just in my head. And that's a great conversation starter to talk about complementary or alternative medicines, but also how important psychological well-being can be in controlling your pain, you know, or when the pain gets intense. So yeah, very much something that I personally and professionally prescribe to, but I'm also seeing more conversation about that in national pain physician forums on, hey, let's not overlook this. Let's better utilize our mental health care providers, our psychologists and psychiatrist colleagues. One of the things we do at our office is weekly, we'll actually meet as a team that includes all of our physicians, those of us that do pain procedures, run pain clinics, run spine clinics. We're also joined by pain psychiatrists and four of our pain psychologists to really make sure we're kind of giving patients a 360 view of treatment options. So yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that we see a lot of success with when patients are willing to do that and commit to it.
Now, Dr. John, I want to ask you this one last question, because this might not be a popular statement to say for some of the people out there, but I'm a gun owner at home. And when I have my gun, it is locked up out of the way of anyone in the house and my kids. Are you surprised how people will just leave their pain pills in their cabinets or on their dresser? I mean, that should be something that should be locked up at all times. Do you agree?
I agree. And one of the things we do in our – so when patients come to our office and they – are on opioids, we have them go to a 2-hour opioid education meeting with one of our other medical directors. And in that meeting, that topic specifically addressed that, you know, these medications should be locked up. They should be in a place that you know where they're at. We also encourage our patients, you know, if they're going to work for the day or out for the day, to only take the medications that are prescribed for that day. And along with that, they should also have, you know, like, you know, kind of what we call an opioid counter agent, like a naloxone or Narcan that's available in the event if someone does have an overdose. So, yeah, I absolutely agree. Yeah, opioids are best locked up in a safe place where the patient knows where they're at. They can take them safely, but they're not out and open to be, you know, diverted through stealing or someone else taking or using. And to kind of be responsible with your prescriptions. Absolutely.
I appreciate it. Our guest today has been Dr. John Benfield. He's the DO at Intermountain Healthcare. We've listened to you talk about a lot of great information that goes right along with Know Your Script. If there was a takeaway that you'd like people to walk away with today, what would you say to that?
The biggest takeaway I would say is take your prescription as prescribed. Any questions, have the confidence to reach out to your provider to have those questions answered.
All right. Hey, thank you very much. You're listening to Project Recovery, a KSL podcast. Coming up, we're going to talk to Kim Campani. She's the AVP of Pain Management Services. We're going to find out what she has to say. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas,
in the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, about recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That is Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. Our show today is more about information and less about stories, and it's brought to you by our friends at KnowYourScript.org. And we just got off the phone with Dr. John Benfield, who was the DO at Intermountain Healthcare, and now we've got the pleasure of talking with Kim Campani. She's the AVP. We found out AVP stands for Assistant Vice President of Pain and Management Services. Kim, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me today.
At Intermountain Healthcare, we should include that. That's where she's the AVP.
And we did a little interview before we put her on, and she told us before she became the AVP, you were actually a pharmacist by trade. So you were a pharmacist back when?
The last time, probably it's been about 6 years since I practiced, but I practiced as a pharmacist for over 20 years.
All right. Before we talk to you about what you're currently doing, we talked to Dr. John about how it's important for a communication between a patient and doctor to get the best outcome for their pain and the release. But for those who don't have time to talk to their doctor, a pharmacist is a great person to get some information from. Is that correct?
That's great. That's correct. In fact, many times pharmacists are the most approachable healthcare profession because you can just stop in at your local pharmacy anywhere and just ask questions. And sometimes it's a great way to even approach a pharmacist that you don't normally see for your prescriptions to say, hey, I've got some questions about pain. What's available over the counter? Can you tell me a little bit more about what my options are? Or maybe tell me about opioids. And so they're a great source of information in addition to meeting with your healthcare providers or your doctors about your pain concerns.
I love that you brought that up, that they're one of the most approachable, because I've always thought, the environment, I usually go to a pharmacy in my grocery store. And so it's like, you're getting the chocolate milk and you're getting this, and then it's like less intimidating. Right. But you said something really interesting, which I would have never thought of. Actually, would a pharmacist mind if you, even if you're not using their services, if you are in the grocery store and you had a question about pain management or something, do they mind if you just approach them and ask, even if you're not filling a prescription?
No, not at all. And absolutely. I mean, we're healthcare professionals, and we love to talk to patients about their healthcare. What can we do to help improve it and help to answer their questions? And they're, on any subject, not just pain management, but yes, please feel free to utilize those resources. It's really important to make sure that we're educating ourselves about what our options are, specifically around pain management. And some of the things is, maybe we didn't have the opportunity to ask all the questions to our physician while we were in those visits. So yes, please utilize pharmacists for those.
Or if you're like me, sometimes I think of the question afterwards, right? You've been in there and maybe the physician was very available to you, but you're driving away from the appointment and you think, oh, I should have asked that. So we can bring those kind of questions to the pharmacist maybe?
Absolutely. And it's important. I think what we want to do is we want to empower patients to make sure that they are asking those questions, no matter when they seem to come to light. And so if you didn't have the opportunity to talk to your doctor while you're in the office, you can always call back. You can always ask other healthcare professionals too, such as pharmacists. But we want people to feel empowered to seek the knowledge and make sure their questions are answered. Specifically, if you have pain, speak up and ask, what are my options for pain? Are there alternatives for me over the counter that I could start with first, such as the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories, things such as ibuprofen or Aleve? Could those work for me for the type of pain that I have? Also, could Tylenol, which is acetaminophen, could that be something that's helpful for me? Many times by combining those two medications and taking them routinely around the clock, kind of a scheduled timing, we can reduce a lot of our pain without having to escalate into opioids. And so just asking some of those questions, seeing what's available. Also asking could things such as ice or some of the over-the-counter patches or numbing creams, those types of things, could those be kind of our first steps, things that we could try before we launch into opioids. So make sure we're asking those questions and feeling really good about our healthcare plan.
Now, Kim, you said a buzzword, and that was reducing. And I'm looking at some of our notes here, and it said between 2017 and 2020, Intermountain Healthcare has been successful in reducing opioids by 9.5, hear this, million fewer pills and reducing benzodiazepines and opioid co-prescribing by 49%. Those are some huge numbers.
They are huge, and we're really proud of this progress. And it's, you know, it's taken a whole system approach to address the opioid issue and the abuse and what's going on in our state. And we've really come together as a healthcare system to say, what can we do to make sure that we're keeping patients safe? Patient safety is our number one concern. While we want to make sure that our patients are adequately treated with pain and we're trying to minimize their pain, however, not always reducing their pain. I mean, that's something that we've got to be mindful of as well. We've really taken a concerted effort as a healthcare system to say, what can we do in this opioid epidemic? What steps can we make to keep our patients safer? And so that's why over that 3-year period, we were able to reduce the number of tablets prescribed, like you said, by 9.5 million. That means, you know, patients were getting alternative care, and those are also less medications that are available out in the community that could inadvertently get into the hands of someone else to cause problems or, more unfortunately than that, an accidental overdose. So we're very proud of that, the work that we've done. But our work is not finished. We still have significant amounts of work to do, and so we are going to continue in these efforts. Some of the things we're focusing on now are really like those high-dose opioid prescriptions. Anytime a patient takes an opioid, they are at an increased risk for side effects or, you know, overdose. But specifically as the potency of those opioids go up, it even puts the patient at higher risk. So we've really heightened our focus last year and this year on those high dose opioids and making sure we're bringing awareness to those particular situations and trying to make sure if an opioid is appropriate for a patient, and many times they are, we want to make sure that patients' doses are as low as they possibly can be and that patients are given the information that they need to hopefully keep them safe.
Now, Kim, I know we've made some great strides in the reducing of opioids, like we said, by 9.5 million fewer pills and reducing by 49%. But there's been some significant rises in synthetic opioids, and that's Tramadol and fentanyl. And for some people out there, do they know what Tramadol and fentanyl are? Does the general public understand what those are?
You know, I think that's a really great question, Casey. And I think some people do, but maybe a lot of people don't. There are prescription tramadol and fentanyl that you can get as prescriptions, but there are a lot of illicit prescriptions. Those are the ones specifically right now that are having a rise across the country and also in Utah for causing opioid overdose deaths. However, while those are continuing to rise, Utah's role in the opioid epidemic is still unique. Utah, while we're seeing those rises in that synthetic opioid overdoses, however, prescription opioid prescribing is still the leading cause of opioid overdose in Utah. So that's something that's important to call out. We still need to focus on the prescription component in addition now to the synthetic component of the opioids.
Now, that's fascinating to know. How does that get better? I mean, people, is that more on the prescriber's side of things? Is that more on the consumer's side of things? How could we reduce that prescription overdose number that you're talking about?
Great. Well, the prescription overdose, that's what we've been focusing on, we say, over the last few years. And we're going to continue our work in this area. So, as we know, the science and the information that's available to us about opioids, about opioid use disorder, addiction, all that is, we know a lot more now than, say, we did 20 years ago. And so the way we're prescribing, the way we're approaching pain it's changing. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to make sure, first of all, that patients and the public, they are informed. We want to reduce the stigma about opioids. And I think that's very important so that people feel like they can have open conversations about opioids if they've had problems in the past and bring that to their prescribers. And then another thing is we want to encourage patients to really ask if an opioid is going to be prescribed to them, to really ask some important questions to their doctor, their nurse practitioner, their advanced practice provider, whomever they're seeing, is, will something else work for me? How long will I be taking this opioid? And are you prescribing the lowest dose possible? And if so, what's the plan to taper me off of this medication? And then, what are the risks for addiction based on what you're getting? And those are some great way to start the conversations between patients and their healthcare providers so that we are making informed decisions together with the physician and the patient, kind of brainstorming around what's best for them, but so that patients feel informed and empowered to be able to have those conversations. I think that's truly important.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think we say on the show all the time that we need to be responsible consumers of our own healthcare, especially medications. But I found people are full of shame about this, and they're embarrassed, and they don't want their physician to think
less of them.
Sure. And but so maybe to help them out, you're the professional here. If you gave several really great questions, I think they were all good. But if you had to pick one, like if somebody was just going to get up the courage to talk to their doc about their opioid prescription, what would be like the number one question you think they could ask that sort of would get that conversation going?
Sure. I think the first thing I would ask was, is there something else that could work for me? Is there something else I could try before an opioid? Maybe start there. And
I think that's great because it starts that conversation of alternatives. But also, I think it's a way,
for the doctor to say, why are you asking this? Is there something that I don't know? Let's talk about
kinda,
this.
Kind of probe a little bit, because I think those of us in healthcare, we learn to be really direct. We talk about all sorts of things all the time. But the average person coming in who's hesitant or anxious about their situation, I think they need to be empowered to ask that one question that sort of gets the conversation going. So I think that's a great one. What are there alternatives to this medication?
Now, Kim, I'm going to take you down a little different road, because you said some things in the opioid epidemic are changing and the way doctors are addressing things are changing. But let's talk a little bit about telehealth, because a lot of people are now utilizing that during the pandemic. Are there some electronic tools that you guys are using to kind of help with the epidemic and what's going on in pain management?
Yeah, great question. We've been trying, as we're trying to increase the focus, we're all working on this together. We're trying to put tools in place to help physicians or those nurse practitioners to help them at the time that they may be prescribing an opioid for the patient. So we have tried to put in some tools for them in the electronic medical record, which would help them to know what's the potency of that opioid that's being prescribed? Because as I mentioned earlier, as those potencies go up, it's something called morphine milligram equivalency, which is, it's a standard measure for opioids to represent the potencies comparing them to morphine. But as those potencies go up, the risk to the patient substantially increases. And so it helps to give the prescribers a better view of what's the potency of the opioid. Are they on other harmful combinations of medications, such as benzodiazepines, sleep aids, or other medications that could cause harm to the patient? Also, letting them know, does the patient already have some opioids on file? I'm just summarizing some of the tools we put in place so that at the time of prescribing, a doctor has more information available to them to help understand what are some of the risks to the patient if they were to prescribe an opioid for them.
So I feel kind of silly because I'm going to ask you a question that I probably should have started out the interview with. But for those who don't know, we're here talking with Kim, and we're talking about pain management. But what is pain management? Does that make sense?
Sure. I think we all think, what is pain management? We all experience pain in some ways throughout our lives. But pain management is actually looking at managing pain appropriately, improving function for people. It doesn't mean we're necessarily going to be able to take away all of the pain, but it's helping people to improve their lives who have pain. And so that encompasses many different factors. The medication component is just one small component of it. We look at a multidisciplinary approach to treating pain. Specifically, what can we do that's non-medication related to help patients? Setting things like, first of all, setting realistic pain goals, improving function, understanding, is it truly realistic that I'm not going to have any pain after I've broken my leg or after I've injured myself? I mean, setting up those goals with those patients so that we can work together to improve function.
Kim, do you find that people come in with an expectation of no pain leaving? I think that sounds best if I were the patient. But so, I mean, do you find that what you just described, which I think is essential, of course, is having realistic expectations. And I've even looked at research that proves that a realistic expectation lowers the pain that the patient experiences. But like, do you find that's a hard conversation to have with people? Are they coming in wanting no pain?
Well, I think if I had the option of no pain, of course I would choose that. But I think that, again, that goes back to those are conversations to have and to ask those questions. Is it feasible that I will have no pain? And, you know, and being and understand that there's a good possibility they may say, we're not going to alleviate all of your pain, but we can improve your function. We can make it, what are your goals? And setting down and setting up realistic goals between the patient and the doctor to understand, you know, I just want to be able to go outside and be able to play with my kids. Or, you know, I might want to be able to take a walk around the block. And just understanding what the goals are and then working towards improving them. That's kind of the first step in pain management. Then understanding what else can we do to treat pain that's not always medication focused. And there are a whole host of opportunities and that can help patients.
Are you going to say yoga? Because yoga fixes everything.
You know, yoga can be one thing. Relaxation, mindfulness.
Meditation, you know, massages.
Meditation, yes.
You know,
that cognitive behavioral therapy.
Oh, there you go. Speaking my language.
A whole host of.
What's your favorite, Kim? Do you have a favorite of those modalities? Something you just, it's kind of your go-to?
Well, I think it kind of depends on the individual person. For me personally, I like, if I'm in pain, sometimes just, depending on what type of pain it is using ice. If I've got inflammation, to make sure that I'm, doing what I can to reduce the inflammation, resting when appropriate, elevating if that's appropriate, just doing some basic things like that. Then also just kind of stepping away into a quiet area and trying some mindfulness techniques can sometimes make it so that the pain feels like it's reduced. And then knowing that there are some over-the-counter options, such as ibuprofen, if the pain gets to that level where I feel like I need to take something else. But of course, that's me, and every person is individual, and we have to find what works best for them.
Now you're speaking my language. You know, you were talking about being realistic and being real with yourself. And I'm 47. I've put my body through a couple wars. And, you know, I expect to feel like a 47-year-old. I think a lot of people go in there with this pain and they go, I want to feel like I'm 23. Well, that's a whole different pill. You know, that's an imaginary pill because that's never going to happen. So we've got to understand that as we get older, things hurt a little bit more, and your body is, you know, is going to be hurting a little bit more.
I woke up the other morning after sleeping and had pulled a muscle in my back. I have no idea how I did it. Woke up, I was in pain all day.
Yeah, that's the age sleep. That's the age we are now, where you can hurt yourself in your sleep. Now, Kim, we're going to ask you the same question we asked Dr. John. If you could have people walk away with one thing from this interview, there's a lot more they're going to be able to because we covered a lot of topics and a lot of subjects and a lot of great information. But is what one thing that they could walk away with going, yes?
I would say, first of all, please feel free to feel empowered. Make sure you're speaking up on behalf. Be your own advocate. Ask those questions to your healthcare providers. Make sure that you're getting your questions answered and make sure you feel good about your healthcare plan. The other thing is, let's also try to reduce the stigma around opioid addiction. It's a substance use disorder. It's a chronic disease called opioid use disorder. It's not a weakness. We need to be having those discussions, and we need to be having them freely and making sure that we're empowered.
Love it. That is exactly what people need to hear, in my opinion, as a psychologist, is bolstering that confidence that comes from being able to ask those kinds of questions and realize it is a disease. It's not a weakness of character. This is something that many people, you know, the old, the young, the rich, the poor, the athletic, the non-athletic, it touches everybody.
It doesn't discriminate.
Mm-hmm. It does not. And we've had 2 years of proof on this show of people from all different walks of life, for all different reasons, getting snared by this disease. And we so appreciate you coming on the show today and sharing that with the listeners. And I hope that'll empower just people listening to you from the other side, you know, from the physicians and the provider side of things, that the providers want to have those conversations.
Kim, if people wanted more information about the good things you guys are doing at Intermountain Healthcare, where would they go to find information?
You just could go to our website, intermountainhealthcare.org, and there's a whole host of information there. And or we'd be happy to take questions. If they sent those to you or any other way they wanted to contact us. So,
well, we'd love to have you back on. Another website where people could find out more information would be knowyourscript.org. The kind of stuff you can find there is how to empower yourself when talking to your doctor, when talking to your loved ones, when talking to your kids. They also can help you with storage and disposal, the risks and resources around you. They say at Know Your Script, speak out, opt out, and, of course, throw out. They're a great information website for you to get that. And, Kim, we want to say thank you for stopping by and sharing your knowledge with us. We really do appreciate it. And if, Dr. John, you're still on, we love you too, man. Thank you for sharing your information with us as well. And you can find all of this by going to our website or knowyourscript.org. So just go check it out on Facebook. So thank you guys very much for stopping by today. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, and we want to say thank you guys for listening today. Project Recovery is brought to you by our friends at KnowYourScript.org, and of course, it is a KSL podcast.
Contents of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was 3 blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.